Next up, we're going to go on to something a little bit different. You've already noticed in behavioral science one simple fact. If you don't like what we're talking about, just wait a moment, we'll go on to something new. We're going to leave behind screening, sensitivity, specificity, positive, negative, predictive value, and go on to talk about another core important area on the exam. Usually, as I structure these lectures together, I like to go from one very important topic to a less important topic and let you rest a little bit. I'm not doing that this time. What I'm about to talk about is every bit as important as what I just did talk about. We're going to talk about study designs. We're going to talk about research designs, bias in research, understanding how to fix bias in research, and understanding how to analyze data from particular kinds of studies. Folks, these questions are easy to anticipate. This is a target that you should know what you're shooting at. They're going to present you with a detailed description of a research study, and they're going to say, what kind of study do we usually call this? They're going to present you with a detailed description of a study. They're going to say, can we believe the results or not? And if not, why not? What's the source of the bias? And another level, how would you fix the bias? They're going to present you results from a research study, and they're going to say, how would you analyze the data from this study, or presenting you with the results? They're going to say, how would you interpret the results from this analysis? These are targets that should not surprise you. These are questions, when you see them on the exam, you ought to be unsurprised when they show up, because they show up, if history's any guide, every year. Let's begin by talking our way through bias. What do we mean by bias in research? Simple. The idea of research is to give us a clear, clean picture of reality. The idea of research is so we're not basing our view of the world on subjective opinions, which can vary, but we have data that gives us a clear, verifiable picture of what the world is. Bias is when our research misleads us. Bias is deviation from truth. If this is truth, then bias means it doesn't match up. This is, of course, a major problem in our research because it means our view of reality is distorted and in error. Now, the two key concepts we're focusing on when thinking about different kinds of bias are reliability and validity. Reliability is easy to define. Reliability means simply consistency. Do you get the same result every time? If I give you a test today and I give you a test next week, I should get roughly the same result. That's called test retest reliability. It's all about consistency. A synonym here, a word that some of you might have learned in other contexts, is precision. By precision, we mean, again, do you hit the same point every time? By contrast, validity. Validity means not did you hit the same point, but did you hit the bullseye? Validity means accuracy. Did you hit what you aimed at? A simple way to understand these is with another pictorial metaphor. Here's a target. Here are now my shots at the target. Is that highly reliable shooting? Well, yes, it is. Notice how the points are clustered together. They are consistent. They're all at the same spot. It is not very valid because although the points are together, I did not hit the bullseye. Validity means I put the shots in the bullseye. Notice from this example that reliability is a necessary but not sufficient condition for validity. I must have reliability in order to have validity, but just because I have reliability doesn't mean I have validity. Reliability means clustering the shots. Validity means clustering them in the bullseye, hitting what you aimed at. You're expected, when presented with a research design, to understand what are the possible sources of bias and to be able to suggest solutions to solving the bias that is in that study should the study be repeated. We're going to spend some time talking down through different types of bias, getting you to understand how they work and how to recognize them. But first, let's understand the mental logic you must use to answer these questions. I'll lay it out now and I'll illustrate it as we go forward. When you read the research design presented before you, you don't automatically leap to what the right answer is. There's a thought process that goes as follows. As you read the study, you go, wait, something's wrong here. Then you say, ah, what's wrong here is, and you identify what's wrong. And then only as a third leap do you then leap to the label that describes what it is that's wrong or an error. Let's try to illustrate that as we talk about selection bias, sometimes called sampling bias. sampling bias. There's something wrong with how I get my sample. My sample, the people in my study, are not representative of the general population which, on which I wish to focus. Suppose the endocolostidae, I select 5 volunteers, give you card tables, some measurement paraphernalia, and send you out to try to get a sense about what is the rate of heart disease in the New York area. To do that, I want you to take your card tables and set them up outside of 5 local health clubs where I've made arrangements and just assess people as they come in and out of the health club. What do you think? Good study to assess heart disease in New York area? Of course not. Why? Well, because, as is obvious, the people that go in and out of the health clubs are not a random independent sample of the general New York population. Now, once again, look at the logic by which you answered that question. You should have said, wait, that doesn't sound right. Then you should have said, people that go in and out of the health club are not representative. And finally, you should have said, we call that selection or sampling bias. Other kinds of sampling bias are a little bit harder to see. Try this example. I was down in Houston teaching a couple months ago. And when I was there, I was able to get all the hospitals in the Houston area to give me access to their hospital discharge records. Using those hospital discharge records, I derived an estimate of the prevalence of tuberculosis in the Houston area. What do you think? Good estimate? No, terrible estimate. Why? Well, because a lot of people with tuberculosis never come near the hospital. That's, of course, the problem. Using medical records to estimate population prevalence has a distinctive name. It's called Berkson's bias. Berkson's bias is a sampling bias problem. It's using medical information in order to make conclusions about the general population. If you listen closely in the popular media, you will hear this bias all the time. The director of public health will come up, hold a press conference, make a statement and say, we're finally getting a handle on tuberculosis in this city. And I know that because we had a reduction in the number of TB cases treated all across our hospitals last year. No, that might not be a good thing. That might be a bad thing. It's not fewer cases. It's fewer people coming into the hospital, which could be a real problem. This is Berkson's bias, a sampling bias problem. A third example. Another kind of sampling bias is something we label non-respondent bias. Non-respondent bias is where people who agree to participate in our study may be different in some strategic way from people that do not agree to participate in our study. Now, non-respondent bias, folks, is only a problem when you have volunteer subjects in your research. That's it. Unless you have volunteer subjects, not a real issue. By the way, when do you have volunteer subjects in medical research? Always. They're not supposed to be in your study unless they volunteer. The basic code of ethics says we do not do medical research on people unless they agree to do it. So this is always a problem. One person once pointed out that the same people that volunteer for medical research are the same people that show up for jury duty. And you have a sense of how that is a non-representative population. You have a sense of what I'm talking about here. This is selection or sampling bias. The people do not represent the general population. Measurement bias is next. Measurement bias, the sample that I have is a good representative sample, but the way I get information from the sample distorts or biases what I get. Sometimes this is easy to see. I'm going to stop people as they walk out from talking to their primary care physician and ask them a few questions about how they feel about their physician. Excuse me, ma'am, can I ask you a few questions? She says, sure. Okay, first question. You like your physician, don't you? Okay. You think your physician's wonderful, don't you? Okay. You think your physician deserves to make a lot more money, don't you? Okay, thank you very much. And having completed my survey, I now publish results in that reputable journal, USA Today. You know that little box on the front page? It says 95% of people surveyed think the physician should make more money. What do you think? Good survey? I didn't say, do you like the results? I said, good survey. No, terrible survey. Why? Because those were what we call leading questions, suggesting the way I asked the question what the answer should be. You found out more about my bias than about her real opinion when you look at the data. Now, that kind of measurement bias is easy to see. Others are a little bit more subtle. I refer, of course, to the ever-popular Hawthorne effect. The Hawthorne effect was discovered, of all places, in Chicago, on the west side of Chicago. In the 1920s and 30s, there was a huge factory called the Hawthorne Western Electric Plant where they made telephone switching components. Some bright young researchers from Yale and Harvard showed up, knocked on the door of the plant manager and said, hey, let us do research here and we'll tell you how to make your people more productive. Translation, they'll work harder for less money. The guy that ran the factory said, sounds good to me, come on in. And he gave him a little room off to the side of the factory where they could set up a production line. And then they proceeded to tinker with features of the environment to see what would make people more or less productive in that special production line. The first thing they looked at was the illumination in the room, the lighting. Gradually, day by day, they increased the amount of illumination until it became as bright as the brightest noonday sun. And then they looked at productivity. You know what they found? As the room got brighter and brighter, productivity went higher and higher. Wow, they said, we're on to something. Make the room as bright as possible, people will work harder. Well, they're at least moderately good researchers, so before they published that, they did one other thing. That is, day by day, they gradually made the room dimmer and dimmer and dimmer, down by one account about the level of pale moonlight. Then they looked at productivity records. You know what they found? As the room got dimmer and dimmer and dimmer, productivity went higher and higher and higher. Oops. Clearly, the lighting is not the issue here. Clearly, lighting is not what's changing people's behavior. What is? Well, if you're trying to decide how something is affecting people in the study, put yourself in the position of people in the study. So you're sitting there, you're at a workbench, you're doing assembly work for which you're being paid. Now, for reasons that are not clear to you, some bright young men wearing long white coats, carrying clipboards, start walking around watching you and writing notes as you're working. What impact might this have on your behavior? Of course, you work harder, you work differently, at least. And that illustrates the Hawthorne effect. Simply put, the fact of being observed changes your behavior. If you know you're being watched, you act differently. The Hawthorne effect is the social science equivalent of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. We're measuring the state of the electron, changes the electron. Measuring you changes you. What's the solution to the Hawthorne effect? Well, there are two, actually. One, non-obtrusive measures. Non-obtrusive measures are when people are being measured and they don't know they're being measured. Now, that may not sound ethical, but sometimes it's very easy and reasonably ethical to do. Simple example. In the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago, they wanted to know which one of their exhibits was the most popular. Now, they could have sent people to watch and count the number of people as they went to different exhibits, but they had a more ingenious solution. They simply looked in the records at where they had to replace the floor tiles most often in the museum. And they found that around the little exhibit where chicks were hatching, they had to replace the floor tiles 6 times more often than anywhere else in the museum. You don't have to be a genius to figure out that's the most popular exhibit. Unobtrusive measure. The other solution to the Hawthorne effect is to have a control group. If in that Hawthorne study, they had had a room which had people in working with the guys with the white coats walking around, and they didn't fiddle with the lighting at all, a simple comparison group, they would have seen productivity going up without any relationship to the lighting. And they would have known productivity was connected to the situation, but not to the lighting. Experiment expectancy. Experiment expectancy effect is our recognition, an important recognition, that what the experimenter expects to find as an outcome for the study is often what in fact occurs. This occurs because the experimenter, in fact, inadvertently makes it happen. Here's how we usually demonstrate this experiment expectancy effect. First, we go into a grade school classroom at the very beginning of the school year. Then we give all the students in the grade school class a test. Now, the test is bogus. It measures nothing. But we tell the teacher, this is a test of students' potential. Further, we tell the teacher, this side of the class, they have great potential. This side of the class, they're just average. Then we walk away. Walk away, come back 6 months, a year later, and we look at the grades. Come on, you know how this ends. Who has all the good grades? The high potential side of the class has good grades. And now, here's the kicker. Now we give a competency test, a test that measures not the teacher's own evaluation, but what students actually learned. Do we see any difference between the two sides of the class? Yes. The high potential side not only got the good grades, they learned more. They deserve the grades they got. The experiment expectancy effect is not as shallow as the teacher is biased in her grading. It's more sophisticated. It's because of her expectation she interacted with these students differently, spent more time with them, taught them more, so they in fact learned more. You can see that this could really screw up a research study. If you're giving a drug to one group and you think it's a great drug, and you're giving a placebo to another group and you know it's a placebo, inadvertently you might well communicate that to the subjects and change the results. What's the solution, therefore, to this experiment or expectancy effect? Simple. It's called double-blind design. Double-blind design means the researcher and the subjects don't know whether they're in the treatment or the control condition, and so the subjects' behavior isn't influenced by that knowledge, and the researcher behavior vis-a-vis the subjects is not influenced by that knowledge at all. Listen closely. Double-blind design means neither the subjects nor the researchers know whether the subjects are in the experimental or the control group. Well, that's true, but this next statement is not true. Nobody knows whether the subjects are in the experimental or the control condition. Why is that not true? Because, come on, folks, clearly someplace somebody has to know, right? That's kind of a stupid issue. If nobody knows, why are we doing this? Yet, on practice questions, we get as much as a third of a class to pick that last statement as the right answer. What's that telling us? You're not reading and thinking about what it is you're marking. The real issue is simple. Neither the subjects nor the experimenters that have contact with the subjects can know whether the subjects are in the treatment or the placebo condition. Lead time bias is next up. Lead time bias, the problem here is we think we've done more good than we've actually done. We believe that our intervention has done more, has been more helpful than it actually has been. Best way to illustrate this is try just to draw you a picture of what I'm talking about. This is when people get the disease. This is when the disease is usually diagnosed, and this is death. Before we do any screening, this is the natural course of events. Disease occurs here, is diagnosed here, and people die here. Now, because we're screening, we have the following change. People get the disease at the same point, but we detect the disease sooner. Diagnosis is considerably earlier. Unfortunately, people die at exactly the same spot. Notice we haven't gotten any additional mortality. In concrete terms, we haven't really done any good for the patient. But if we're not careful, we're going to be subject to lead time bias. Lead time bias will lead you to say something like this. Hey, people are living now longer and longer with the disease than ever before. No, they're not. They had the disease just as long. You just found out about it sooner. They're not living with it longer. We just detected it earlier. This is not necessarily a good thing. If we can't help you live longer, but now you just can worry about your disease for longer, this is not the best outcome. This is the outcome we're looking for in our screening. The outcome we're looking for is by detecting the disease earlier, now people live longer. We're looking for increased survival at the back end, not merely increased detection at the front end. Confusing this front end increased detection and considering an increased survival is what lead time bias is all about. Recall bias is next, and recall bias is fairly easy to describe. Recall bias is something that is a problem in retrospective studies, studies where we're going backwards in time. In recall bias, people simply don't remember. They don't remember and can't tell you accurately what happened that you're trying to find out about. Now, if people don't remember and tell you they don't remember, this is not really that much of a problem. The problem is when they don't remember, and to keep you happy, they make something up. Ask yourself, January 29th of last year, what do you have for breakfast? If you say you don't remember, that's fine, but if you don't remember and you say, well, I had a bagel and cream cheese, just to give me an answer, that's recall bias. Recall bias, the problem is people don't remember, but they tell you something anyhow. Late look bias. Late look bias is where because we're not likely to uncover or have severe cases of disease to interview, we get a wrong impression about what disease symptoms or the disease course is. A simple example is as follows. I'm going to do a survey detailing the symptoms of HIV/AIDS. And so I go around to the hospitals in the area and I interview every HIV/AIDS patient I can find. And lo and behold, my catalog of symptoms says the symptoms of AIDS are relatively mild. There are not many severe symptoms here. They're not things that really disrupt people's lives very much. Why do I say that? Because all the people with severe symptoms have died. They're not around to talk to anymore. They're not there so I can actually spend my time and get their information. This is late look bias. Severe cases are not uncovered because they're more likely to be dead. Finally, confounding bias. In your notes, put a star by this one. It's subtle. It's a little bit different than the others, but it's probably the most important of the set. And confounding bias, there's something that is associated with the factor that you're looking at. And so you can't separate out whether the effect you find is due to the factor you're looking at or due to that other associated piece. Confounding means something is found within. Things are wrapped up together so you cannot separate them apart. Two simple examples of confounding. I'm doing a study. Look at the efficacy of two antihypertensive agents. One antihypertensive agent I give to group A, the other I give to group B. And I now follow both groups forward in time and see which one ends up with lower blood pressure. Unbeknownst to me, however, the first group, in addition to taking the new antihypertensive, also undergoes a radical dietary change. They all become vegetarian. At the end of my study, I find the first group now has much lower blood pressure than the second group. Here's the problem. Is that outcome due to the drug, or is that outcome due to the vegetarian diet? I can't say. That's what confounding is. Confounding is just that. You can't say which factor really produced the results. I was asked to do a consult a couple of years ago, a consult on a study that some of the pediatricians in my hospital wanted to do, looking at the rates of asthma in the west side of Chicago, where I'm from. Now, this is an important study because the rates of asthma, morbidity, and mortality are frankly higher there than almost anywhere else in the United States. They wanted to do four things for their intervention. They wanted to go into this community and provide education for the students about what symptoms were, where to get help. They wanted to provide in-service for the teachers in terms of how to recognize asthma symptoms and where to refer the students. They wanted to do medical education, continuing medical education with physicians in the area, making sure they knew the most advanced treatments, including the use of anti-inflammatory steroidal medications. And they wanted to do a publicity campaign, billboards, signs on the side of buses, radio ads, making sure the general community awareness was increased. They said to me, what do you think about my study? I said two things. One, you're going to impact the rate of asthma. Two, you'll have no idea why. The problem with that study is you did four interventions, and if you got a change, you don't know which intervention made it happen. A good study has one and only one intervention so you can pull out what the effect is in fact due to. If you don't have that, if you're arguing about what the real reason for the results are, it's not this thing, but it's something else over here, that's what confounding is about. Things wrapped up together, something found within something else, so you can't separate it apart.